This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. We're taking a look, yes, a feminist look, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses in Victorian Britain, North America and beyond. Why did these women do it? The answer lies in the world in which they lived. And we'll need our very best detective skills for this particular murder mystery, which has confounded people for over 100 years. It's the case of Lizzie Borden.
Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whack. When she seen what she had done, she gave her father 41.
The male journalists covering the trial were horrified by the spectacle of women clamoring for attendance. Joe Howard described the audience in the courtroom as a sea of calico mixed with silk.
The idea that this very calm woman could, using a hatchet or axe, kill two people, that just didn't fit any of these investigators' image of what a proper upper-class woman would do.
If she were an ordinary woman, she would have cried and cried. The difficulty is she is not an ordinary woman. She is a puzzle psychologic.
I'm joined by Emmy-winning journalist Erin Moriarty, who's looked closely at Lizzie for her CBS show 48 Hours. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Lucy. This case, even though I've worked on it, still fascinates me, no question.
Why is that, Erin? Why is it so addictive?
You had this investigation that really involved a collision of two worlds, this wealthy woman being investigated by individuals in a very different economic class, working class, police officers, mostly Irish immigrants, trying to resolve this mystery that was a deep mystery back then and remains today.
Oh, you've whetted my appetite. Now, this case has all the elements of a classic locked room murder mystery. There's a house, two brutal killings, and a limited cast of characters. The main, indeed the only real suspect, seems to be above reproach. 1892 in New England, and the bustling Massachusetts mill town of Fall River is a centre of textile production. It's powered by an immigrant European workforce from countries like Ireland and Portugal. Some people are getting rich here, namely the Protestant church-going white elite, who mainly live in an exclusive neighbourhood called The Hill. But Andrew Borden, a self-made property developer, prefers to live instead in a modest house near the centre of town with his second wife, Abby, his two unmarried daughters, Lizzie, who's 32, and Emma, who's 41, look likely to remain spinsters, dependent on their father for money, and where and how they're going to live. Lizzie throws herself into charity work. Cara Robertson has researched this case for 30 years, and she's the author of an award-winning book, The Trial of Lizzie Borden. She's in Fall River, on 2nd Street, right outside the Borden house.
It's a busy street, right near the center of town, as it was then. The house is painted a dark green, approximating the drab color in 1892. The house now is a bed and breakfast. The house is a perfectly nice house, except that no house is big enough if you're living with people you hate. Hi. Hi. I'm in the Borden house. This is where the murders actually took place. There were five people in the house. Lizzie Borden, her older sister Emma, their father, Andrew Borden, his wife Abby, their stepmother, and Bridget Sullivan, the maid. This was a district for the middling sort. Andrew Borden was a self-made man. Most of his wealth came from real estate development. He was notoriously tight-fisted, and the house reflected his interest in cost savings. In many respects, the Borden household looked like a normal Victorian family, but there were details of the house that spoke to the tension within. Lizzie and Emma ate separately from their parents, and they entertained their guests upstairs in a guest bedroom rather than in the parlor. It was not a happy home. The house was a converted tenement house, and so one has a sense of confinement, partly because there are no hallways, and what one has most strongly is a sense of no privacy. Although they had some income of their own, the daughters lived on the weekly allowance of a factory worker. They were essentially trapped, albeit in a fairly comfortable cage.
Emma and Lizzie are known to dislike their stepmother, Abby. Their father remarried 2 years after their mother's death, when the girls were 14 and 5. They avoid speaking to their stepmother unless absolutely necessary, and they certainly don't call her mother. So when Andrew Borden gifts Abby's sister a house, the girls are furious. Lizzie moves furniture to block the door connecting her room to her father's and stepmother's, while Andrew and Abby start keeping their own bedroom door locked. With the elder sister Emma away, visiting friends in a neighbouring town, the 4th of August 1892 begins like a seemingly normal Thursday in the Borden household. Andrew Borden comes home for lunch earlier than usual because he's feeling unwell. The entire family had complained of upset stomachs the day before. Around 11, Lizzie finds her father slumped on the sofa at a very odd angle.
Maggie, come down!
What is the matter?
Come down quick! Father's dead! Someone come in and killed him! Oh, Maggie, don't go in!
Miss Lizzie, where was you?
I was out in the backyard and heard a groan and came in and the screen door was wide open. I have got to have the doctor.
The Bordens call their Irish maid Maggie, but she's really Bridget Sullivan. She fails to find a doctor. When she comes back, a neighbour, Mrs. Churchill, has arrived on the scene. Lizzie asks them both to go upstairs to look for her stepmother, Abby. They find her in the guest room, face down on the floor. Her skull, like that of Andrew downstairs, has been caved in from multiple axe blows. Police officers arrive, many of them from Fall River's working class and Irish community. And they find Lizzie odd, too calm, too poised, they think. Their first instinct, though, is to round up the usual suspects, members of the Portuguese immigrant community who occupied the lowest rungs of Fall River's social ladder. But there's no evidence to connect anyone to the time and the place of the murder, apart from Lizzie and Bridget the maid. The police let the usual suspects go. I'm joined by Erin Moriarty, a CBS journalist with a law degree and host of the podcast My Life of Crime. Erin, it seems to me that the police don't do a particularly good job. Why do you think that is?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Number one, we're talking about Fall River, which is a small town between Boston and New York. And this kind of vicious, brutal crime is not something these police officers were familiar with. So really, within minutes of finding Andrew Borden, people were coming into the house and stepping over what would be evidence. These were police officers who were mostly working class, who had very little contact with people like Lizzie. The other problem, too, is the idea that this very calm woman could, using a hatchet or axe, kill two people. They were killed about an hour and a half apart, and go about her chores. That just didn't fit any of these investigators' image of what a proper upper-class woman would do. But there's another problem, and that's the gender gap. You had these investigators, mostly men, who actually have an intriguing piece of evidence, a bucket found in the basement filled with bloody rags that in anybody's mind would be evidence to examine. But Lizzie dismisses it by saying that she's having her period. And there is a squeamishness and they just accept it.
I can see that the officers might have been sort of unduly impressed and deferential towards this rich, white, posh lady. And then bring in menstruation into the equation as well. Oh, my goodness. I'm sure that there's lots of men today who would be really uncomfortable with dealing with an issue like that.
I think they would. But I think it would be investigated today.
Just days after the discovery of the bodies, an inquest is held in the Fall River Court building to determine the cause of death. Since the murders, the family doctor has been giving Lizzie morphine to calm her nerves. Later, her lawyers will present medical testimony that morphine can affect your memory and give you hallucinations. Nevertheless, Lizzie's questioned aggressively by the district attorney, Hosea Knowlton.
When you saw your father, where was he?
On the sofa, lying down. I was so frightened and horrified, I ran to the foot of the stairs and called Maggie.
Did you notice that he had been cut?
Yes, that is what made me afraid.
Did you make any search for your mother?
No, sir. I thought she was out of the house.
You made no effort to find your mother at all?
No, sir.
Who did you send Maggie for?
Dr. Bowen. I says, go for Dr. Bowen as soon as you can. I think father is hurt.
You saw him?
Yes, sir. I opened the door and rushed back.
Saw his face?
No, I did not see his face because he was all covered with blood.
Did you see his eyeball hanging out?
No, sir.
See the gashes where his face was laid open?
No, sir.
It seems odd to people that Lizzie didn't go and look for her stepmother immediately. And Lizzie's also inconsistent. Let's go back to Carla Robertson, who's heading to the guest room at the Borden house.
As I go up the stairs, I can see into the guest room where Mrs. Borden was murdered. Here in this guest bedroom, Abby Borden was found face down, felled with 19 blows to the back of her head. It was hard to believe that Lizzie Borden did not know whether or not her stepmother was in fact in the house, and harder still to believe that she would not have heard her fall. The prosecutor at the trial said that the whole house must have shook when poor Abby fell to the ground. The day before the murders, Lizzie Borden had tried to buy prussic acid, a deadly poison. It was only sold on doctor's prescriptions, and Lizzie didn't have one, so she was unable to get it. Lizzie said that she wanted the poison to clean a sealskin cape. Now, it was August, and no one had ever heard of such a use for a poison, so that seemed quite implausible. Apart from Bridget Sullivan, the maid, Lizzie was the only one known to be at home at the time of both murders. Abby Borden sent Bridget Sullivan out to wash the windows on the morning of the murders, and she was spotted doing so, and so that ruled her out as a suspect. We're walking down the basement stairs. The only flush toilet was down here in the basement. One of the things the police found here was a pail of bloody cloths. Lizzie Borden said they were menstrual towels, and the family doctor backed her up. And the towels were not taken into evidence. It's hard to imagine what sort of constraints women operated under at that time. Lizzie drifted from one task to the other, a little sewing, a little embroidery, ironing. She had no alibi.
So Lizzie has no alibi. Her story's full of inconsistencies, and it keeps changing. She's the only viable suspect. 3 days after the inquest, she's arrested, and she's sent to prison to await trial for murder. Lizzie is now set to inherit her father's money, so she hires a good and expensive defense team, including the former Massachusetts governor, George D. Robinson. Lizzie certainly had the opportunity to commit the murder, but what about the motive? Erin, now you know this trial inside out. The money motive seems like a really obvious one to us, but would it have been as clear to the jurors in 1893, do you think?
Well, it was certainly part of the state's case because Abby had to die first. If Andrew Borden died first, his money would go to Abby's family. But the defense did a good job at this trial of pointing out that both Emma, her older sister, and Lizzie had some assets of their own.
Why do you think that the jury found it difficult to imagine a woman like Lizzie Borden doing this?
Remember, the jurors were all men. Women could not be jurors back in 1893 when the trial was held. And so these are men who are watching everything that Lizzie does. And she plays the part of the upper-class woman. She dresses well. That's in the papers every day about how she dresses. Everything she does, her calmness, it seemed a contrast against these horrific crimes.
You've become familiar with a large number of murders through your work. Is it not fair to say that a crime involving an axe is less common for a woman to commit?
I think so, even today. That type of crime we don't associate with women. But there was testimony at trial that Lizzie could have done it, was physically capable of doing it. It just was hard for the jurors to believe that.
At the trial, Lizzie plays the role of a lovely lady. She dresses beautifully. She brings to court every day a bunch of fresh flowers. The drama ratchets up when the district attorney calls to the stand Dr. William Dolan, who conducted the autopsy.
Did you see the bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Borden?
I made a thorough autopsy on the 11th of August at the Oak Grove Cemetery.
Did you afterwards remove the skull of Mr. Borden and remove the flesh from the bone?
Yes, sir.
And you have it in your possession?
Yes, sir.
Did you also remove the skull of Mrs. Borden and have it now in your possession?
Yes, sir.
Did you form any opinion as to the position of the woman when she was assaulted?
I believe that the assailant in the case stood astride the prostrate body of Mrs. Borden as she was lying face downwards on the floor.
As to all the wounds?
As to all except the flat wound on the scalp on the left side of her head. It is directed from the front backward. I think that one was given while Mrs. Borden was standing and facing her assailant.
Now, Lizzie hasn't been told that her father's head was going to be produced. And perhaps not surprisingly, she faints. But Dr. Dolan has concluded that Abby was struck from the front, which is important. It indicates that this was a personal crime, a crime of hatred. Cara Robertson is going to talk us through some of the exhibits from the trial, which remain today at the Fall River Historical Society.
I'm looking right now at a key exhibit, the handleless hatchet. The blade itself is about 3.5 inches long, and the size of this blade does match many of the wounds on Mr. and Mrs. Borden. It's a little rusty now, and it feels heavy, but it does seem small to have inflicted so much damage. What I'm looking at now is Abby Borden's hair. It's grayish brown and looks very different than the brown 4 or 5 inch extension, obviously severed during the attack. So Abby Borden wasn't immune to female vanity. She was wearing hair extensions at the time of her death. Now I'm looking at the notes of the police officer who interviewed Lizzie Borden. He writes, "Lizzie stood by the foot of the bed and talked in the most calm and collected manner, most remarkable under the circumstances. There was not the least indication of agitation, no sign of sorrow or grief, no comment on the horror of the crime, and no expression of a wish that the criminal be caught. All this gave birth to a thought that was most revolting. She knew more than she wished to tell. Reporters from around the country came to New Bedford, Massachusetts, to cover the trial. About a third of the audience were women. To women especially, the notion that someone like Lizzie Borden could have committed these murders in such a brutal way was of particular fascination. Elizabeth Jordan, the most famous female reporter at her trial, said, "Every picture which has been made of this woman either absurdly flatters her or grossly maligns her. She notices things like the way that she tended her hair with a perfect curl in her bangs." The male journalists covering the trial were horrified by the spectacle of women clamoring for attendance at this trial of horrors. Joe Howard described the audience in the courtroom as a sea of calico mixed with silk, indicating the range of social classes interested in the outcome. Under the heading, "Where to Look for Your Wife," the Fall River Daily Globe advised, "The New Bedford man who comes home and finds it deserted needn't be alarmed. There has been no elopement. The dear creature is probably in the crowd of morbid females who are storming the door of the county courthouse trying to get admission to the Borden trial."
So, Aaron, listening to all these different reports, this must have been the trial of the decade in New England, do you think?
Oh, I believe it. It is very similar today. What's the difference? Where we would have wall-to-wall television coverage, it was day-to-day print coverage. And what I find most remarkable is the newspaper was telling men where they could find their wives. If their wives weren't home making dinner, they were probably at the trial.
Do you find, Erin, that your own viewers and listeners are more female than male?
Oh, they absolutely are.
And why? What's your explanation for that then? That's really interesting.
I think because people want to deal with their biggest fears. And often in these cases, the bad person is convicted and put away. And so it's putting women's fears right out there and dealing with it.
On the 14th of June, 1893, the prosecution rests its case. Public support is behind Lizzie. The packed courtroom and crowds outside don't have to wait long for a verdict. After just 1 hour and 50 minutes, the judges resume their seats and the jury come back in.
Lizzie Andrew Borden, stand up. Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon your verdict?
We have.
Lizzie Andrew Borden, hold up your right hand. Mr. Foreman, look upon the prisoner. Prisoner, look upon the foreman. What say you, Mr. Foreman?
Not guilty.
Immediately after the trial, the Boston Globe newspaper fought this. If she were an ordinary woman, she would have cried and cried,
perhaps fainted, then smiled and reasserted the habitudes of her sex. The difficulty is, she is not an ordinary woman. She is a puzzle psychologic.
Lizzie, along with her sister Emma, retreat to the large, imposing, Queen Anne-style McMansion on the hill, the grandest, highest part of Fall River, which they buy with their inheritance. But the town enacts its own kind of punishment on Lizzie. Returning to church, she finds the pews all around her stay empty. She's frozen out of Fall River High Society. Why? Perhaps by acting as if she might have got away with murder. So, Erin Moriarty, it's fair to say that Lizzie Borden has gone down in popular culture as guilty, right? Even though she was acquitted.
Yes, and I think it's really more because she seemed to violate the rules of social civility after she was acquitted. Her own attorney in the closing said that she and her sister Emma would go back to their bloodstained home, but they bought this amazing house on the hill. Lizzie starts hanging out with an actress by the name of Nance O'Neill, and they appear to be so close that there were rumors that they were romantically involved. And so I guess there was an expectation that she would display humility after she was acquitted and show gratitude. And instead of living it down, she was living it up.
Sort of living out the dreams that she cherished when she'd been the pawn in her father's house. This is really against Lizzie then, do you think?
Well, yes, because it was the purported motive. That's what the state had said, her reason for killing. And in fact, she seems to exhibit that motive right afterwards instead of living humbly. And the feeling that she might have gotten away with it has remained with Americans ever since.
Do you see any echoes of this in women's lives today? Have we sorted this out?
I think we have sorted it out in terms of women having to kill parents in order to have any kind of money of their own. But you still see money being a motive. So I think that if the motive in 1893 was killing her parents for money, today it would be for life insurance.
Have you in your career, Erin, covered cases that have any modern echoes of what we're talking about?
The case that comes to mind immediately is a young woman by the name of Casey Anthony. Her daughter disappeared in 2008, and I think there would have been sympathy for her, but she waited 2 weeks to call the police. And then in the meantime, she gets a tattoo and she goes dancing. And so she goes on trial in 2011. And she's actually acquitted. Just like Lizzie Borden, there is a lack of direct evidence. And yet today, she's still a pariah, as much for the way she acted as a mother as for the death of her daughter. I think you can look at cases where women are put on trial as much for their crime as for the fact that they have violated perceived social norms. They didn't act the way they should.
What happens in the end to one of America's most notorious women? Lizzie's sister Emma eventually gets fed up with Lizzie's behavior. She moves out of the Mack Mansion. After 1905, the two of them never speak again. Lizzie lives on alone with her dog in the grand house on the hill, dying in 1927, aged 66. But in the annals of American folklore, Lizzie lives on in countless books, in plays, in an opera, and even in a children's nursery rhyme. Guilty as charged.
Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whack. When she seen what she had done, she gave her father 41.
Thanks to our guests, Erin Moriarty and Cara Robertson. Next time on Lady Killers, we head north to 19th century Canada, where a teenage domestic servant is accused of murdering her boss, then going on the run. It's the case made famous by Margaret Atwood in Alias Grace. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Diane Hope. The music's composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Colleen Prendergast and William Hope. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Since the war began, my inbox has been flooded. People from Ukraine, Russia, and Britain are getting in touch with me. They're telling me about a very different battle, but one that's also having real consequences for the people caught up in it. I'm Mariana Spring, and in this new podcast for Radio 4, War on Truth, I'll be reporting on the extraordinary information war being waged over Ukraine and hearing from the ordinary people sucked into it. This blatant denial of reality is being waged by trolls, state media, influencers, online and beyond. From BBC Radio 4, War on Truth. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.